content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. And we'll begin with this story. The U.S. is on the verge of meteorological malpractice. This was written by Michelle Nyhus. On Tuesday afternoon, the risk of wildfire in northeastern Colorado had risen high enough that Xcel Energy, the state's largest utility company, announced that it would shut down power in much of the area the following day. Expected high winds, combined with the current dry conditions, meant that a downed electrical line could spark a catastrophe. Local institutions responded by announcing closures yesterday, among them the Boulder, Colorado-based National Center for Atmospheric Research, or NCAR. Shortly after the Xcel announcement, USA Today broke the news that the Trump administration planned to dismantle the center. Climate scientists know NCAR as one of the largest weather and climate research institutions in the world. Russell Vogt, the director of the Office of Management and Budget, described it as, quote, one of the largest sources of climate alarmism in the country, end quote. NCAR had already reduced its staff in anticipation of drastic budget cuts at the National Science Foundation, which provides about half of the center's funding. In March, a major NCAR project meant to track hurricanes and other severe storms was canceled after the administration pulled back money appropriated for it. Now efforts to dissolve the center would begin immediately, USA Today reported, and would include a full disclosure of the center's full closure of the center's Mesa Laboratory, whose distinctive rose-hued towers designed by I.M. Pei have overlooked the city since the 1960s. Antonio Busilaki, the president of the consortium that operates the center, was in New Orleans at the annual meeting of the American Geophysical Union along with many of the center's researchers. Busilaki issued a brief statement acknowledging the reports but noted that, quote, we do not have additional information about any such plan, end quote. That's essentially still true. At a press availability at the conference today, Busilaki said, I don't want to be facetious, but I don't know what the best definition of immediate means. He defended NCAR's work, which would be more costly if it was broken up, he said, as well as the impartiality of its researchers. We are physical scientists. We are not political scientists, he said. Like many of the institutions and agencies targeted by the Trump administration this year, USAID, the Forest Service, the National Institutes of Health, NCAR is vulnerable in part because so few Americans know what it does, if they've heard of it at all. Established in 1960 to advance the field of meteorology, which had flourished during World War II but languished in peacetime, the center was designed to coordinate research on the problems of the atmosphere and provide the large-scale computing facilities necessary for that work. It now employs more than 800 researchers and makes its facilities available to thousands more each year. Catherine Hayhoe, a climate scientist at Texas Tech University and the chief scientist of the Nature Conservancy, called NCAR quite literally our global mothership. Daniel Swain, a UC Agriculture and Natural Resources climate scientist known for his commentary on extreme weather events, hosted a rapid response live stream. Most academics in the weather and climate world, he said, have in some way passed through or connected with the National Center for Atmospheric Research. Swain, himself a research partner at NCAR, spoke to his audience from Boulder, warning that the area's planned power shutoff could bring his report to an abrupt end. He described the administration's plan for NCAR as a genuinely shocking self-inflicted wound. Whether or not Americans know it, research at the center has contributed to enormous advances in the weather forecasts they consult each day. Three-day forecasts have been more than 80% accurate since the 1980s and are now about 97% accurate. Five-day forecasts hit the 80% threshold in the early 2000s, and seven-day forecasts are approaching it today. NCAR researchers have also enabled more precise predictions of tornadoes, hurricanes, wildfires, and other extreme events. The center has been so successful, Swain observed during his live stream, that we now take it for granted. The fact that we are not caught by surprise when a hurricane makes landfall. The fact that we can predict the occurrence. Literally, as I speak, the winds are picking up outside the window. Of these extreme fire weather conditions. The dissolution of the center could disrupt climate science and its applications in more fundamental ways, interfering with access of ocean temperatures, volcanic activity, seasonal ice and snow cover, and other factors. They began to approximate the climate. NCAR's newest climate model, the Model for Prediction Across Scales, or MPAS, can simulate both large-scale atmospheric patterns and small-scale weather events. Today, predicting the weather without considering the climate would be meteorological malpractice. Human-caused changes in the global climate have fundamentally changed the weather, making extreme conditions not only possible, but also more likely. Without ongoing research on climate change, forecasters would be less able to predict deadly weather events such as last week's flooding in the Pacific Northwest and heavy snow in the Midwest and Northeast. And they may not have seen the Colorado winds coming in time for electric utilities to take preventative measures. Swain signed off his live stream yesterday as the wind picked up in Boulder. By noon, Xcel Energy had shut off power to nearly 100,000 of its Colorado customers. By 4 p.m., the weather station at NCAR's Mesa Laboratory was measuring wind gusts of more than 100 miles per hour. Our second story. The truth physics can no longer ignore. This was written by Adam Frank. On October 8, 2024, the field of physics was plunged into controversy. That day, the Nobel Prize for Physics was awarded for discoveries not involving black holes, cosmology, or strange new subatomic particles, but about AI. How could the discipline's highest award go to research about machines designed to mimic human brains? Where was the physics in that? For most of the 20th century, physicists largely ignored living systems. They understood living things as machines, albeit ones made of gooey parts. A subfield called biophysics uncovered specific physical mechanisms behind those molecular machines. Organisms as a whole, however, were not a major concern. But today, many of my colleagues in physics no longer agree with such dismissals. Instead, we have come to believe that a mystery is unfolding in every microbe, animal, and human. One that challenges basic assumptions physicists have held for centuries and could answer essential questions about AI. It might even help redefine the field for the next generation. The central hubris of physics has long been the idea that it is the most fundamental of all sciences. Physics students learn about the basic stuff of reality, space and time, energy and matter, and are told that all other scientific disciplines must reduce back down to the fundamental particles and laws that physics has generated. This philosophy, called reductionism, worked pretty well from Newton's laws through much of the 20th century as physicists discovered electrons, quarks, the reality of the theory of relativity, and so on. But over the past few decades, progress in the most reductionist branches of physics has slowed. For example, long-promised theories of everything, such as string theory, have not borne significant fruit. There are, however, ways other than reductionism to think about what's fundamental in the universe. Beginning in the 1980s, physicists, along with researchers in other fields, began developing new mathematical tools to study what's called complexity, systems in which the whole is far more than the sum of its parts. The end goal of reductionism was to explain everything in the universe as the result of particles and their interactions. Complexity, by contrast, recognizes that once lots of particles come together to produce macroscopic things, such as organisms, knowing that everything about particles isn't enough to understand reality. An early pioneer of this approach was physicist Philip W. Anderson, who succinctly framed the nascent anti-reductionist perspective with the phrase, "More is different." Complex system science has grown rapidly in the 21st century, and researchers in the field won the Nobel Prize for Physics in 2021. From a physicist's perspective, no complex system is weirder or more challenging than life. For one thing, the organization of living matter defies physicists' usual expectations about the universe. Your body is made of matter, just like everything else, but the atoms you're built from today won't be the atoms you're built from in a year. That means you and every other living thing aren't an inert object like a rock, but a dynamic pattern playing out over time. The real challenge for physics, however, is that the patterns that make up life are self-organized. Living systems both create and maintain themselves in a strange kind of loop that no existing machine can replicate. Think about the cell membrane, which enables a cell to stay alive by letting some chemicals in while keeping others out. The cell creates and continually maintains the membrane, but the membrane is also itself a process that makes the cell. That chicken and egg problem challenges the dream of the old physics, that once the universe's fundamental particles were cataloged, everything else would be explicitly described and predicted. Give me a young star, and I can use the reductionist laws of physics to predict that star's future. It will live a million years rather than a billion years. It will die as a black hole rather than as a white dwarf. But the components of a living organism yield something new and unexpected, a phenomenon called emergence. Give me a simple cell from the early days of Earth's history, and I could never predict that some 4 billion years later it would evolve into a giant rabbit that can punch you in the face. Kangaroos, like humans, are an unpredictable, emergent consequence of life's evolution. The fundamental laws that govern matter and energy cannot predict another fundamental property of life. It is the only system in the universe that uses information for its own purposes. Plants grow toward light, microbes swim toward rich food sources, animals hide from predators, humans send giant metal contraptions into outer space. Although one can, say, program a robot to search for a wall plug when its battery gets low, a living thing, a human programmer, for example, must hard code that need into the machine. Life, by contrast, is both agental and autonomous. From microbes to crabs to people, all living things have their own itches to scratch. To truly understand living systems as self-organized, autonomous agents, physicists need to abandon their, quote, "just the particles, ma'am," end quote, mentality. One of physicists' greatest talents, starting with the law of simple parts, such as atoms, and working up to a complex whole, cannot fully account for cells, animals, or people. Luckily, the field has another elemental skill that can help, a particular way of asking questions and building models to make predictions. Physicists have always been good at capturing the essential aspects of a system and casting those essentials in the language of mathematics. How much useful energy flows through a cell membrane? which arrangement of neurons maximizes the information in a flatworm's nervous system. Now those skills must be brought to bear on an age-old question that is only just getting its proper due. What is life? Using these skills, physicists working together with representatives of all other disciplines that make up complexity science may crack open the question of how life formed on Earth billions of years ago and how it might have formed on the distant alien worlds we can now explore with cutting-edge telescopes. Just as important, understanding why life as an organized system is different at a fundamental level from all the other stuff in the universe may help astronomers design new strategies for finding it in places bearing little resemblance to Earth. Analyzing life, no matter how alien, as a self-organizing, information-driven system, may provide the key to detecting biosignatures on planets hundreds of light years away. Closer to home, studying the nature of life is likely essential to fully understanding intelligence and building artificial versions. Throughout the current AI boom, researchers and philosophers have debated whether and when large language models might achieve general intelligence or even become conscious, or whether, in fact, some already have. The only way to properly assess such claims is to study, by any means possible, the sole agreed-upon source of general intelligence, life. Bringing the new physics of life to problems of AI may not help researchers predict what software engineers can build. It may also reveal the limits of trying to capture life's essential character in silicon. As the 21st century continues to unfold, my fellow physicists will undoubtedly continue to advance the study of black holes, quantum mechanics, and other traditional domains. The study of life, however, will take us to places we've never imagined, opening a path for our future of our field that, for once, unfolds on a level playing field with biologists, ecologists, neuroscientists, and sociologists. At its best, the pursuit of fundamental answers about the nature of living things might lead physicists not only to new scientific marvels, but also to an entirely new way of doing science. Our third article, Why the Supreme Court is Giving ICE So Much Power, written by Nancy Gertner, a senior lecturer at the Harvard Law School and a former federal judge who served from 1994 to 2011. Untold numbers of ICE agents have appeared on America's streets in recent months, and many of them have committed acts of aggression with seeming impunity. ICE agents have detained suspected illegal immigrants without cause, including U.S. citizens and lawful residents. They have, in effect, kidnapped people, breaking into cars to make arrests. They have used tear gas and pepper spray on nonviolent protesters. They have refused to identify themselves, wearing masks, using unmarked cars and switching license plates, presumably to avoid detection. They have kept people in detention without access to lawyers. They have questioned people simply for appearing Latino, speaking Spanish, and being in areas believed to be frequented by illegal immigrants. Many of these tactics are plainly illegal. The Constitution incontestably applies to federal immigration officers. The Fourth Amendment protects against unreasonable searches and seizures and excessive force and requires a warrant to search a private home. The Fifth Amendment guarantees due process and bans self-incrimination. The Sixth Amendment establishes a person's right to counsel. Why, then, are they getting away with not following the Constitution? Their impunity traces back to two Supreme Court decisions that put far too much faith in ICE's commitment to respecting people's constitutional rights. As a result of these cases, people whose rights are violated by ICE agents have little or no recourse. Contrast that with rules for police officers. If a police officer kicks down your door and searches your home without a warrant, questions you without a Miranda warning, or illegally arrests you, a provision known as the exclusionary rule may prevent the evidence gathered through those tactics from being admitted in your prosecution. If you happen to be acquitted, you can sue for damages. None of that is true when it comes to ICE. The first of these two cases is a 1984 decision, INS versus Lopez Mendoza, that untethered ICE from exclusionary rule. In a 5-4 opinion, Justice Sandra Day O'Connor rejected the exclusionary rule for immigration courts, favoring instead, quote, a deliberately simple deportation hearing system, end quote. In a typical criminal case, the exclusionary rule is designed to deter police misconduct. The idea that being that the police will avoid such conduct if it risks undermining a conviction. But for ICE, the court decided, such deterrence is not necessary. Unless ICE conduct amounts to an egregious violation of the Fourth Amendment, the evidence that agents gather, even though illegal means, can be used in immigration courts. Key to the court's decision was a presumption that Fourth Amendment violations by ICE officers were not widespread, and that the Immigration and Naturalization Service has already taken sensible and reasonable steps to deter Fourth Amendment violations by its officers. Such assumptions may not have been reasonable then. They certainly are not reasonable now. A second court decision appears to have eliminated, or at least seriously limited, the possibility of lawsuits for damages after individuals are unlawfully detained, searched, or experience excessive force at the hands of ICE. When the police engage in misconduct, the victim can sue the responsible officers for damages. Again, not so for ICE. In the 2022 decision, Egbert versus Bully, Justice Clarence Thomas, writing for the majority, defined the rights of plaintiffs to sue Border Patrol agents for excessive use of force in the name of national security. There is every reason to believe that the Supreme Court would extend the rationale in Boole to shield ICE from liability as well. The court would effectively be greenlighting ICE's abusive tactics and insulating agents from damages when they are, in fact, no different from any state or city police officer who violates a person's constitutional rights. As in INS versus Lopez Mendoza, the rationale in Boole relies on the agency's purported ability to self-regulate. After all, Thomas suggested, Border Patrol must investigate alleged violations and accept grievances. Can anyone count on such care when it comes from Border Patrol under this administration? Again, the faith in these institutions to self-regulate seems tragically misplaced. The remaining options for someone mistreated by ICE are inadequate, to say the least. An individual could file a lawsuit under the Federal Tort Claims Act against federal officers, but that law has its shortcomings. A person must submit a detailed claim to the government and wait for a response before they can go to court. That process can take years and years. An individual could also file a complaint with the DHS Office of Inspector General or the Office of Civil Rights and Civil Liberties, which would theoretically launch an investigation. But in this administration, the chances of redress for misconduct are slim to none. Nothing drives the point home more than the case of a CPB commander, Gregory Bovino, the U.S. District Judge Sarah Ellis, found that he had lied to the court about whether he had used excessive force against protesters in Chicago. Was he dismissed or disciplined? Neither. He went on to lead another immigration sweep, this time in New Orleans. Then there are practical problems with contesting ICE misconduct. Where in the United States is the immigrant? In which detention facility? Do they have a lawyer? Worse, What if they have already been deported through a process known as expedited removal? Expedited removal generally involves a determination by a low-level immigration officer who, in many cases, during a single interview, determines that the non-citizen arrived in the U.S. without proper documents and therefore cannot prove that he or she has been physically present in the U.S. for 2 years. Exceptions are made only for people who have a credible fear of persecution or torture, or who intend to apply for asylum, exceptions that have been severely limited under this administration. Although expedited removal used to apply only to non-citizens within 100 miles of the border, Trump's Department of Homeland Security has expanded the policy to apply to any unlawful non-citizen anywhere in the country who cannot prove 2 years of residency, giving them no time to secure counsel or gather evidence, no right to appeal, and surely no meaningful due process. Even for those who manage to get before an immigration judge, the process is formidable. ICE attorneys have been systematically asking immigration judges to dismiss proceedings in order to strip individuals of even the limited protections those hearings afford. Judge Gia Cobb, a federal judge in Washington, D.C., noted in a recent decision that people have been arrested immediately following dismissals, subjected to expedited removal, and shortly removed. These tactics, combined with the administration's expanded policy of mandatory detention, meaning the immigration is not intended to bail, have turned immigration courts into what the former chief counsel for Joe Biden's Citizenship and Immigration Services characterized as a deportation pipeline. Much of what ICE is doing is not remotely constitutional. The court decisions that laid the groundwork for the agency's lawlessness no longer stand up to basic scrutiny. As Justice O'Connor said in INS versus Lopez Mendoza, our conclusions concerning the exclusionary rule's value might change if there developed good reason to believe that Fourth Amendment violations by INS officers were widespread. There's more than good reason. There's every reason. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.